everyone who loves books. This is Read on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, your weekly compendium of the best in books and reading. I'm your host Red Sail, and this week there's menace in the air as we explore a slew of brand new thrillers. CJ Tudor unveils her spine-chilling follow-up to The Chalk Man, The Taking of Annie Thorne.
But I do like to have a slightly darker, creepier edge of something that perhaps aren't entirely explained, and it leans towards that a little bit more in Annie Thorne.
Debut author Ian Skewis gives tartan noir a twist in A Murder of Crows.
As it transpires with all these things, it ends up getting more and more complicated, and he's on the trail of a serial killer who's just getting started.
And former Murder Squad detective Kate London explores gangs and knife crime in Gallows Tree Lane.
And I was very affected by seeing these boys, meeting them as suspects, as witnesses, as victims, but then also, sadly, of course, dealing with their murders.
That's all coming up in today's Read On. CJ Tudor's debut novel, The Chalk Man, was an international bestseller that drew praise from fans and fellow authors alike, including Stephen King. A deliciously creepy thriller set on the outskirts of an English town, it established CJ Tudor as one to watch. And, judging by the first few chapters of her follow-up, The Taking of Annie Thorne, she's done it again. It's got me hooked and checking the doors and windows before I go to bed.
Never go back. That's what people always tell you. Things will have changed. They won't be the way you remembered. Leave the past in the past. Of course, the last one is easier said than done. The past has a habit of repeating on you, like a bad curry. I don't want to go back, really. There are several things higher up on my wish list, like being eaten alive by rats or line dancing. This is how badly I don't want to see the crap hole I grew up in ever again. But sometimes there is no choice except the wrong choice.
CJ Tudor, welcome to Read On.
Hello, thank you for having me.
So, before we come on to talk about Annie Thorne, I'd just like to take you back to before the publication of The Chalk Man, because the story about that is just every bit as good as fiction. Tell us about the inspiration for The Chalk Man and where it came in your sort of writing career.
Right, well, I mean, basically, I mean, I'd, like a lot of debut authors, I've actually been writing for probably over 10 years, sort of trying to get somewhere. And I've got close, and I've had a lot of rejections, and then I sort of get a bit closer and then have some more rejections. And I sort of got to a point, in fact, a lot of writers get to, where you know you've got something, you know you're not bad, you're not terrible, but you're at that point of thinking, am I ever going to get that break? Am I ever going to just get to that next level? And particularly at that time, I'd had my little girl. She was 2. I was running a dog walking business at the time, traipsing around muddy fields with dogs for, 6-7 hours a day. So, time was quite short to fit in the writing with everything else. And I think I had got to that point of thinking, maybe this might just have to remain a hobby. Maybe I'm not going to get that break, but, life is good in other ways, and I still enjoy writing. And then someone gave my little girl a tub of coloured chalk for her second birthday. And as you do, we went outside and we took them outside and we started drawing on the driveway. And we did, the flowers and the rainbows and things. And then my little girl wanted to draw stick men. And so we covered the driveway and these kind of multicolored stick men doing various weird things. And I just went inside and kind of forgot about them. And then later that night, I opened the back door to let our dog out and the security light came on. And it illuminated these weird chalk figures all over the driveway. And what seemed really innocent in the daytime, suddenly, in the darkness, looked incredibly sinister. I actually jumped. I was like, oh, my Jesus Christ, what the hell is that? Because it was as though they just appeared there, but I'd completely forgotten they were there. And I actually remember I called my partner and went, these chalk men look really creepy in the dark. And it really was one of those light bulb moments. There was sort of a bing, and I was like, chalk men, could do something with that. And I started writing it the next day. Obviously, the title changed to The Chalk Man somewhere along the line. But the idea of this childhood game that becomes increasingly sinister, leapt off the page really right away. And I wrote it really quickly. I wrote it in about 8-9 months, the first draft. I wouldn't say that I knew I had something, because I don't think you ever do. You sometimes write something and think it's good and it gets roundly rejected. But I did think there was an idea there. So when I did eventually send it off to an agent, I was sort of keeping my fingers crossed, but still very wary of getting my hopes up too much, because I'd been burnt quite a few times before. But when I did get the call, that the first agent, the one I really wanted, loved it. It was amazing. And it kind of went relatively quickly from there on in. But each stage, I was kind of telling myself not to get my hopes up. Because that's what I kind of do. I was like, well, I've got an agent, but the publishers have probably all rejected it. So I wouldn't let myself get too excited along the way. But it was amazing. And then actually, amazingly still, lots of publishers wanted it. And it actually went to auction, which is kind of every writer's dream, really.
And then the icing on the cake, possibly your favourite author of all time, Stephen King, tweeted about it.
I know. When they ask the publisher to do it, so I'll say to you, because they approach, you know, other writers asking them, read your book and say nice things if they like it. And obviously at the top of my wish list was Stephen King, because he's my hero. And the Chalk Man was in many ways a homage to Stephen King and all the things that I loved when I was a teenager. Stephen King, kind of creepy sort of movies, things like The Goonies and The Lost Boys, all that sort of 80s horror and Stephen King stuff that was wrapped up in my teenage years. And then he's been my hero. I've read him since I was 12 when I first picked up a copy of Christine from the library. I am one of his constant readers. I've read everything throughout my life. And when I said that, I thought, well, that will never happen, but he would be my dream person. And then, I was sat on a train going into London, actually, and I just opened up my Twitter when I probably should have been working. And it was the first tweet I saw, the first thing that popped up. And I had to check it wasn't a fake account because I didn't believe it. I thought it might be winding me up. But yeah, it was the most amazing thing, the thought that Stephen King had read my book and tweeted about it. And so I sort of applied to him, and I didn't actually expect him to reply back, but he just replied and said, "You rock." I was like, that is it. That is my gravestone. I'm done now. I don't do anything else. Stephen King says I rock. That is the ultimate. It was just awesome. I get a huge grin every time I think about it still. It was just, the best thing ever. I say the best moment of my life, and then I have to quickly say, apart from having my daughter and meeting my partner.
Now, as you've indicated, The Chalk Man deals with what should be innocent, a childhood game that leads into something very sinister. Eddie, the hero, has to revisit events of 30 years beforehand when he and his bunch of teenage friends have an innocent game, signalling to each other through these chalk men where they're going to meet up, and somebody hijacks that and it leads them to discover a body. And 30 years later, he receives a letter with a single chalk man and events kick off again. The Taking of Annie Thorne is similar kind of territory. Your protagonist comes back to odd goings-on that were never resolved at the time.
Yes.
What leads you to revisit the past like that? It's incredibly atmospheric, and actually I think a lot of us revisit those thoughts at 2 o'clock in the morning in our heads.
Yeah.
But not all of us write them down.
With The Chalk Man, obviously I'd always wanted to write something with that particular book, with a gang of kids set in the 80s, because that was very much when I was growing up. And the idea of, I say, revisiting all those fond memories and not so fond memories was something I've thought about doing for a long time. And then I think tying it up with events in the present worked quite well, because again, the characters were a similar age to me. And so it worked quite well in that respect. It was almost in a way, myself revisiting my teenage years and childhood. And in The Chalk Man, I wanted to explore, say, not only those fond memories, but that darker side of childhood as well. Because we do tend to sometimes view our childhood years and school days through the rose tinted glasses. And actually, for a lot of children, it's a really horrible, scary, dark time. If you're bullied, if you're having a bad time at school, it can be absolutely the worst years of your life. And children, as well as being, wonderful, can be incredibly cruel. And I think, you're still finding a moral compass at that age. And that's quite an interesting thing to play with in terms of writing. Because, there are things that I've seen happen in schools and other friends have told me about that have happened, that you think if that happened in the adult world, we'd be getting the police involved here. But it's somehow within schools and childhood, we kind of write off as think it's just bullying, everyone's got to go through it type of thing. But it can get really quite dark. That was something I wanted to explore. And again, with Annie Thorne, yes, it's a similar thing. I'm going back to this stuff happened when the protagonist was younger. It's not sort of with The Chalk Man, obviously I did a chapter set in the 80s and then the next chapter set in 2016. So it's not quite that same sort of cutting back and forth between the timelines. But it does center a lot on what happens to Joe, the protagonist, when he was 15. No, that's when his little sister disappeared for 48 hours. And then she came back, but something wasn't quite the same. Something had changed in her, and it's what happened to her. And it's set in a small mining village in the north of England. I went to school in a small mining village in the north of England, strangely enough. So it draws very much from my time, sort of at senior school. It's a Chalk Man was just before that time. This almost is a little bit about me writing about things that I remembered from the senior school, because as I say, it was a school in a small mining village. And I set this particularly during the miners' strike parts of it, because again, I was at school during that period. And I think that idea of the industry dying, things dying, whether stuff can ever be brought back, was very much a theme of the book, because obviously we join Joe later when he comes back to the village, and it's very much the heart's been ripped out of it, the mines are closed. It's a very grim place that's never really recovered from what happened then, in the same way that Joe's never really recovered from what happened with his little sister and all the other events when he was a teenager. So yeah, I think it's fun to play with sort of those ideas. I think a lot of us sometimes have that, oh, you know, I wonder what happened to that person from school. I wonder, revisiting those old friends and you haven't seen them in years can be an interesting experience.
And I suppose also it's when the good turns to bad, when the rot sets in.
Yeah.
Both your books start with quite violent events, which I think, whilst The Chalk Man, it doesn't venture into the supernatural, there's definitely a sense of a release of potential energy that starts bad things happening. Are you grounded in when natural things could be interpreted as supernatural, or are you drawn to a sort of more spiritual dark side, as Stephen King is sometimes?
I like playing with both, actually. I think in The Chalk Man, although there were undertones that were there could be something perhaps supernatural going on here, who's leading these chalk drawings, how they appeared, and obviously there are some sequences with the main protagonist where we weren't sure and he isn't sure what's real and what's not real, actually. But I think in The Chalk Man, we have all our answers, but very much in real life. It's more about people and, you know, and the consequences of people's actions rather than some supernatural bogeyman. I think in The Taking of Annie Thorne, I venture a little bit more in the supernatural territory. That shouldn't scare anybody. It's very much a mystery still. And I think you can interpret it in any way you want to be fair, in some regards, again, because I do leave some questions a little bit open to interpretation, which I deliberately wanted to do. But, you know, most of your answers to the mysteries are, again, they're there in people's actions. There is no, what I call the kind of the Scooby-Doo ending. There's no cop-out where, oh my God, it was a monster that did it, or, you know, it was. I don't like those endings. I like to have things resolved in real life. This is what happened, and this is why it happened, and it's a consequence of what someone did here. So I like to have pretty much all those answers there for people. Don't feel cheated, because you should never cheat your reader. Even if you're playing with something a little bit more out of the natural realm or supernatural. I hate using the word supernatural in some regards, because it just makes you think of ghosts and ghouls and werewolves and vampires, and that's not really what I write. But I do like to have this slightly darker, creepier edge of some things that perhaps aren't entirely explained, and it leans towards that a little bit more in Annie Thorne. But it is primarily very much a mystery, and I hope the answers are satisfactory to everybody at the end.
Well, so far I'm finding it a mystery laden with dread.
Well, that's good too.
And I wondered what scares you.
Oh, God, everything. I think actually you can't write creepy, scary stuff unless you have a healthy amount of fear yourself, because you're often playing upon your own fears, really. I sort of say, you know, if someone says, what's the worst that can happen? I can tell them in great detail. I just know that even silly things, that even though I'm like 47 years old now, I still have that fear of going out into the dark, of something coming around the corner, or something being just behind me, or the hand on my shoulder. I used to live in a little terrace house at one point, and it had a cellar, as a lot of little terrace houses do, and the door to the cellar was in the living room, but it didn't lock, and it didn't quite shut properly. There was this little sliver of darkness. Every night I used to sort of stare at that door partially open. I used to hate going down there anyway, because there's just something about it that was creepy. Eventually, I couldn't live with it. I just always imagined a hand creeping around the door, and I had to put a bookcase in front of it eventually. And I think it's that part of your imagination that works really well if you like writing creepy or scary stuff. You still maintain that almost childlike fear of things coming out of the dark, or just stupid fears of what could happen. I was on an aeroplane the other day, and I was in the wrong seat. I checked it wrong, and I got on the wrong side of the plane. And a woman came on and said, oh, no, don't worry. It's basically the seats are the same. I'll sit the other side. It doesn't matter. Then immediately my morbid mind started thinking, yes, but what if the plane crashed and only one of us survived because we swapped seats? And so I think it's that macabre imagination that you just can't help thinking these things. I wish I could stop them.
Well, you're clearly not stopping. I know that I'm talking to you just after you've finished the proof of your third novel.
I have, yes.
Which is an incredible work rate.
I like to keep going, because I always like to have ideas on the back burner. I just suppose it's that kind of like, now, particularly now I've got something published, it's that idea of, like, I must keep writing. The panic, I must get the ideas out there. But I've always had lots of ideas. My problem used to be in finishing them. And also, of course, you know, obviously getting out there and getting something published. But yeah, I've just finished the first draft of book three. So that's with my editor at the moment, actually. And I will await her notes on it, but they're really happy with it so far, which is good news. Because the panic in sending stuff off never goes away. That kind of, as soon as you press the send button, you go, oh God, no, it's the worst thing I've ever written. Why have I sent it? I like to keep the rate up. I can't stop writing. I'm actually working on a short story. I said I was going to have a month off, but I've got a couple of short pieces of fiction that I've promised. And I love it. And I think most writers will tell you they write because they love it. And actually, you can't stop writing. You just have to do it.
And its title is Other People, I believe?
The Other People, yes. Be suitably creepy.
Oh, good. And The Taking of Annie Thorne, I believe, has a different title in the United States.
It does. It's called The Hiding Place in the United States. Just sometimes different markets, different publishers prefer a certain title. But yeah, I think both work equally well. It has caused a little bit of confusion. Quite often you'll have different covers, but I think different covers and titles have meant there's been a little bit of confusion. A couple of people have said, which is really nice, oh my goodness, I've ordered both. I've gone, that's lovely, but please don't. You'll be getting the same book.
You mentioned the covers, and I obviously couldn't see the cover of either of your books, but I've had them described to me by my children. They, again, play on adolescent or childish themes, but in a little bit of a spooky way, don't they? If you could describe them.
Yes, on The Chalk Man, the cover was fairly obvious, really, I suppose. It was a chalk hangman on just a plain black background. But it's quite a tactile cover as well, because you feel it. It's got almost like a chalky feel to it, actually, the cover as well. And the Taking of Annie Thorne in the UK, I think what's nice is my publisher's very keen to keep that kind of identity of the books going. So again, it's a black cover, and it's got like a cut-out paper doll with a little bit of blood on it. And again, that kind of like chalky writing, like you get sort of on a blackboard even. And along the spine on the original, on the Chalk Man cover, we had lots of little chalk men. And on the spine of Annie Thorne, we've got like a row of cut-out paper dolls, which is lovely. And when they told me what they were going to do for the covers, I was like, oh, yeah, that's great. That's perfect.
And did you have much to do with the selection of the narrators for the audiobooks?
I didn't, actually. No, both times they said to me, this is who we're thinking of. And both times I just went, oh, yes, that's perfect. Because I think I've been very lucky in the choice. So obviously we had Andrew Scott, Essie Butterfield, yeah, who voiced the Chalk Man. So we had to have a young voice and a slightly older voice for that. That was wonderful. Like, they did a marvellous job. And I'm very lucky again. I've got Richard Armitage voicing The Taking of Annie Thorne, who, again, is just absolutely brilliant. I've heard some of it, and I went in for a little bit for the recording. And it's a totally different thing, hearing your words read out. It's a strange thing, actually, because although I used to work in commercial radio, so I used to write those really annoying radio adverts. So I was used to reading stuff aloud, and I very much like, in a way, I still write it by writing spoken words sometimes. I like to keep my writing quite informal. But it's still strange hearing your own words read out like that, I think, when it's the book. And you get inferences and things that you perhaps didn't even quite imagine in your own head, but when someone else reads it, they just give that whole new different light. And I love that. I love hearing it. So I always do, actually, when I've gone twice now to Studios Pearson for recorders, and I always have that slight dread that I will hear something and go, oh, I wish I'd change that line. But no, the narrator's just been absolutely marvellous and very lucky.
Also, I know that some authors have heard their audiobook versions and gone, oh my goodness, I've given away who the murderer is because it's being read in a Brummy accent and there's only one Brummy character in the entire book. And I know Mark Billingham has gone back and rewritten some of his books for Talking Books.
That's perfect, actually. I suppose it's what, the internal voice of the nameless killer, and then it's given away. I never thought of that, actually. Oh, no, that'd be awful, wouldn't it?
Well, you haven't done it yet, and hopefully you won't do it now.
Fortunately not yet. I don't think that would happen in anything I've written, so I was just trying to think about book three now. But no, I think fortunately with the construct of the books and the way they're narrated, and obviously the first to the first person, which makes it easier, I think. Yeah, I don't think there's any giveaways yet, but it's made me think that I shall bear that in mind in future.
Well, I've given you something to stay awake at with 2 o'clock in the morning, haven't I? as you've indicated, your protagonists are male, and certainly before looking you up, I didn't know whether CJ stood for Charles James or Caroline Joanne or whatever.
Caroline James, yes.
Was that a conscious decision to go by your initials, or were you asked to by the publishers?
No, obviously a lot of people do, and there are a lot of authors who do choose initials to be gender neutral so people don't know. But actually, no, it was just more along the lines of when I was thinking of what I would submit it under. My full name's Caroline Jane Tudor, so the initials are obviously CJ. And Caroline Tudor, for me, just didn't sound like a creepy crime writer. I don't know, it just sounded a bit too flowery. So everyone called me Kaz, actually, short for Caroline. But again, I thought at the time, oh, Kaz doesn't sound very authorish. I have since met Kaz Freer, who's also an author and a good friend, and it worked for her fine. But at the time, I thought, maybe Kaz isn't an author sort of name. So I just thought I'd plumped my initials, and then the publishers, they were happy to go with that, really. I didn't think of it in a very sort of publishing way, or didn't think about it in terms of trying to hide whether I was male or female. It just looked right on the page. It was as simple as that, really. But yeah, I suppose it does work because, I do often write in gender opposite. But yeah, it wasn't really a very planned out decision to do that, to try and fool people and make people think, because it wouldn't work very well anyway, because you flip to the end of the book and see a picture generally. So, when people try and do that, it's not as if you can sustain that illusion for very long anyway. So it's kind of pointless, really.
Have you got special plans for the evening of the book launch? Is it going to be in a spooky setting?
No, at the moment, we're going to do a book launch back in, because I've actually recently moved, because we moved slightly closer to family. And after 5 years, we really needed babysitters. So, but I'm going back to Nottingham to have the book launch there, because obviously book two is set in Nottinghamshire, which is pretty appropriate. And I lived in Nottingham for such a long time. It's kind of my hometown. I used to go to the Waterstones there all the time. So it's a huge privilege to sort of do stuff with them. Now I'm sort of an author and I've got books out there, and they were hugely supportive of the first book. So we're going to have a little bit of a launch there, get some people along, get friends and anyone who wants to come along really to it. And I'll be rambling on, as I do, about the book. And there's wine, I'm told. There's going to be wine, so that's good. And then, Roy will go to the pub afterwards. There are some really good, actually, kind of creepy pubs in Nottingham, because there's sort of a lot of pubs. There's a few that are built into caves and things. And Nottingham's got quite a good gothic atmosphere and history. So I'm sure we'll find somewhere to partake of a few bevvies in a suitable environment.
Well, I wish you all the very best for the launch and for the success of the book afterwards. And I hope you come back onto the show when The Other People is published in, about a year's time?
It will be probably, yes. 2020, it's looking like, yes. So, yeah, I'd love to. Thank you very much.
Well, CJ Tudor, thank you so much for being a guest on Read On.
I don't like driving. I try not to whenever possible. I walk or take buses or trains for longer journeys. Unfortunately, Arnhill is not on any main bus routes, and the nearest train station is 12 miles away. Driving is the only real option. Again, sometimes you have no choice. I signal and turn off the main road, onto a series of even narrower, more treacherous country lanes. Fields of turgid brown and dirty green sprawl out either side. Pigs snuffle the air from rusted corrugated huts, in between tumble-down copses of silver birch. Sherwood Forest. Or what remains of it. The only places you're likely to find Robin Hood and Little John these days are on badly painted signs above run-down pubs. The men inside are usually more merry, and the only thing they'll rob you of is your teeth, if you look at them the wrong way.
The Taking of Annie Thorne, narrated by Richard Armitage and written by my guest today, CJ Tudor. Out now in print, audio and ebook. The Chalk Man is available from the RNIB Library in Braille and giant print, with the talking book version on its way soon. And CJ Tudor will be back at the end of the show to share the books of her life. You're listening to Read On, RNIB Connect Radio's one-stop shop for book news, reviews and author interviews. Still to come in this week's show, former police detective Kate London tells us about her authentic new crime novel. But before that, Murder of Crows is an atmospheric crime thriller with dark psychological undertones. Published in print and ebook last year, it's just come out in audio.
He wiped the sweat from his hands and muttered, more from habit than anything else, "Sorry." His wife didn't like him swearing in front of the kid, even though he knew from experience that his son had learned a few choice swear words himself. A teenager to the hilt. Jack was about to turn round to see if he was all right, but decided against it. He didn't need to. He could feel Jamie staring at him accusingly with his mother's eyes. Therein lay the other reason he chose not to turn round. The estrangement from both wife and son hurt like hell. He stayed still for a few moments, thinking about bad omens and impending doom. It seemed as if the crow had been flung at him from afar by the hand of God.
Its author Ian Skewis joined Robert Kirkwood in our Glasgow studio.
The story concerns a detective who is on his final case. His name is DCI Jack Russell, and he is on the hunt for a missing couple, and he is led to believe that this will be solved as a matter of course. And as it transpires with all these things, it ends up getting more and more complicated, and he's on the trail of a serial killer who is just getting started.
Is the setting very important to the book?
Very, yeah. It's set in a fictional village on the west coast of Scotland called Hobbs Bray. And Hobbs Bray kind of has its own climate. It's in a valley, and the weather is quite perpetual. It kind of has its own weather system. So that adds to the claustrophobia of the book and the characters all being a bit on the dark side, shall we say.
Yeah, it's kind of, it's brooding. You always feel that if there's not a storm happening, it's on its way.
Yeah, there's always a sense that there's something on the horizon. There's a sense of impending doom all the way through the book, and it's highly atmospheric. That's a certainty.
Whereabouts is Hobbs Bray?
It's on the west coast of Scotland, but it is fictional. It's kind of an amalgamation of... I grew up in Dumbarton, so a lot of Hobbs Bray is based on childhood country walks. You know, I grew up in an area of Dumbarton called Bellsmire, so a lot of it is a kind of... almost a rose-tinted, but very dark rose-tinted view of all those childhood places rolled into one.
Has it anything to do with Hobbs End?
Yes, it does, as a matter of fact. I'm a big fan of Quatermass and the Pit, and I wanted to create a village that sounded, first of all, very, very Scottish, hence the Bray, but also wanted it to have an inclination of something quite dark and doomy. And of course, Hobbs End from Quatermass and the Pit was so it was a nice little nod or reference to Nigel Neal, who I'm a big fan of, so it became Hobbs Bray.
Now, what do you think it is about Scotland and the climate that lends itself to crime novels?
I think Scots people generally are very grounded as a race. They're very practical. You know, certainly, you know, if you have a look at Glasgow and its history, you know, we were kind of the backbone of the revolution, you know, in Victorian times. So there's a real kind of, but there's also a kind of a dourness about the weather in Scotland, you know, in the short days during the winter. And I think that lends itself very, very well to crime books. There's, you know, of course, Glasgow being, you know, has its fair share of crime, as do other cities in Scotland. But I don't know how much that's exaggerated, but certainly I think we've got that kind of outlook that lends itself to dark storytelling.
Mm. And there's much more in the book, A Murder of Crows. There's much more than the disappearance going on. First of all, there's a conflict between DCI Jack Russell and his underling Colin.
Yes, they don't really get on very well. Colin has an agenda, and not a particularly pleasant one. But what I've tried to do with all the characters is they all have their fair share of dark and light. But Colin, as you will find out, as you will discover, has a very... maybe not a great reason for doing what he does, but he does have a reason for it, and perhaps it's quite a surprising reason.
And the only people who seem to like each other are the people that disappear.
Yeah, I did a radio interview with Shirley Whiteside, and she actually really liked the fact that everybody has a dark side, and you know that gets shown. It's not for everyone's, you know, liking. I know in America, I think they seem to prefer their books a little bit with a bit more chink of light. This book, it is very dark, and everybody has their own problems, and they're very much shown. But I wrote it very much as an ensemble piece. It's not so much all about Jack, you know.
There's also Alice, and you describe the, I don't want to call them time jumps or the fugues she has from inside her own head, which as a reader was quite frightening.
Yeah, she is actually the most popular character in the book, and she was my favourite to write. And when I got all the reviews, a lot of people talked about Alice, and it kind of gave me an inclination as a debut author where my strength lies. But she goes through a real terrifying thing because she has she suffers from an early onset of dementia. And to then put her in a person like that in a crime story, that makes it doubly terrifying. So I wrote it entirely from her point of view. So the reader is literally inside her mind and body as all these things are happening to her.
Now, you mentioned it as a debut novel. How did you fund it and get it out there?
I signed a contract with Unbound, and for those of you who don't know, Unbound are a traditional publishing house, but they use crowdfunding methods to raise the finances to pay for the editing and the book jacket. And so I had 3 months to raise the money. I had no idea how I was going to do it. I'm not from money, my family isn't. But we managed it about 2 days ahead of schedule, which was amazing. And I still can't quite believe we did it, looking back on it.
Now, I know in these crowdfunding things, there are wee rewards you get for certain amounts. What were some of the rewards you were offering?
I think the basic one, because at the time this was only going to be, when I signed the contract and started the crowdfunding, it was only going to be a digital book, and it wasn't until 8 months later that the paperback was then announced, and that was long after the crowdfunding was completed, so that was a nice surprise. But certainly the digital book was at the very basic level, and then there would be limited edition prints of the cover of the book, and the biggest one, if I remember correctly, was that I would take the reader on a guided tour of some of the locations featured in the book. And I actually had a lovely lady who came all the way over from San Francisco. She was coming over anyway to Scotland. Right. Don't get me wrong. It wasn't all about the book. But she was coming over anyway. And she thought, well, I'll kill two crows with one stone, as it were. And I took her to some of the places in Dumbarton where the book was based. And also Glasgow does feature to a smaller extent in the novel as well.
Now, you are here because we're talking primarily about the audiobook, which you read yourself. How was that?
It was really enjoyable, and they really they were a great team. This was down in a studio in Leicester with W.F. Howes, and I used to be a professional actor, so I had a little bit of, although I haven't acted for many, many years, I did have that, a bit of nous about it, I guess. But I still had to audition for it. they didn't say yes straight away. They said, well, we'll need to hear your voice and see if it's suitable for our purposes. So I still had to send them a voice tape. Thankfully, they said yes. And I gather the audiobook, which is now out on CD as well, is doing very well. The last time I looked, it was at number 2 in the mystery charts on Audible.
Fantastic. Now, did you resist the editor inside as you were reading it?
You kind of have to, because you you have to be true to the characters. But what the problem was, and I'll try not to repeat this again, was that I had about 30 characters in the book, and I had to think of not necessarily voices for all of them, but I had to change the pitch slightly for every single character. There were a couple of accents for some of the really small, you know, kind of cameo roles, if you like, that are in the book. And I thought, if I ever do a book again, I'll maybe not write quite so many characters, or I'll get someone else to narrate it.
And at the end of the book, there are still a few threads that remain. Are we going to revisit Jack Ruckle?
Yes, I always had the idea that this was at least part one of a two-part story, but I didn't really dare promote it or advertise it as such. At the very I won't give away too much, but at the end of the book, it does say very, very obliquely that Jack will be back. And I kind of wrote that with the fingers crossed. But yeah, there are a few unanswered questions. But the book is set up in a way, I mean, the very first line in the book is nothing ever ends. Everything is a prelude, a prologue to something else. And that becomes very, very important in the plot of the book. And without giving too much away, that yes, there are some unanswered questions at the end, and yes, there will be a sequel, which I hope to start working on quite soon.
But before that, there's going to be another book.
Yes, I'm working on the second draft of what's currently called Book 2. I do have a title for it, I'm just not going to unveil it yet. Mm-hmm. And this is the story. It's a very, very unusual story. How it came about was I was writing the sequel to A Murder of Crows. I'd written about 40,000 words of it, and one character was screaming to be heard, and she was a supporting character in the sequel. And I realised after a while that I really needed to tell her story, and she needed a book to herself because it's such an extraordinary story that she has. And basically, her name is Police Constable Annie McLeod. She's at the start of her career, unlike Jack Russell. She suffers from nightmares, she suffers from depression, stomach cramps, abdominal migraines, heavy periods. She's got a lot of physical and mental issues. She's trying to help solve the case of a missing 5-year-old boy in the mountains. It's a mountainous village that she lives in. All these, so it kind of becomes about her trying to resolve the mystery of her mind and body as much as it is about the boy. The boy, incidentally, bears a striking resemblance to a boy that she murders in her nightmare. So there's a real complete mystery about this woman, and she just doesn't know. There's no known post-traumatic stress disorder. The doctors haven't been able to figure out what's wrong with her body. And all these really strange threads come together in a very shocking and surprising way. I don't think it's ever been written in a crime book before. Mm. They say there's nothing new under the sun, but it involved a lot of medical research, and I had to speak to a surgeon as well about it. And I really love Annie McLeod, and I think she's a really determined character. And this book may or may not be related to A Murder of Crows in some way. It depends how things pan out over the future, the next few months.
Now, if this just the second draft, do you have an estimated time of publishing for that one?
Again, it depends. This is there's a lot up in the air with Book 2, and once Book 2 is finalised, then everything should slot into place. And the best way to keep up to date with that is actually the newsletter, because the subscribers will hear about it before anybody else. So if people are interested, that's the best way to keep tabs on what's coming next.
And how can people get in touch?
Well, I set up a website, which is www.ianskewis.com, and I also publish a free monthly newsletter, which you can subscribe to via the homepage of that website as well. But I'm also on Facebook and Twitter as well. I can easily be found.
Ian Skewis, thanks so much for joining us on RNIB Connect Radio.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
With his composure regained, he was soon back on the road. It was only some time later that he realised the radio signal had disappeared. He fiddled with the knobs, but nothing came, only a distant static and the hiss of white noise. Finally, he switched it off, and as he drove towards his destination, he began to settle into his usual mode of forecasting bad things for himself. For a long time he had been haunted by the idea that he'd been cursed with some kind of second sight. But as the years went on, he perceived that with so many doubts and fears fluctuating inside his psyche, it would only be a matter of time before at least some of them came true. A law of averages. Even when good things happened to him, he'd immediately expect the worst.
Thanks to Robert Kirkwood and Ian Skewis. A Murder of Crows is available in Braille and giant print from the RNIB Library. The audiobook is on sale commercially. You're listening to Read on RNIB Connect Radio. Coming up later, the cheerfully creepy books of C.J. Tudor's life. But before that, Kate London is an old friend of the show. Her gripping crime novels are made even more compelling
by the authenticity she brings to them. Her latest book, Gallows Tree Lane, goes behind the headlines about gangs and knife crime, portraying its effects on both the community and the police investigation team. Kate London, welcome back to Read On.
Thank you for having me.
Gallows Tree Lane begins with a teenager staggering out of a London side street and bleeding out on the pavement. And for those of us who live in London, it is an all too familiar story. And yet you go behind the headlines, don't you?
Yes. So I worked homicide, as you know, and I was very affected by seeing these boys, meeting them as suspects, as witnesses, as victims, but then also, sadly, of course, dealing with their murders. And I was always very struck that we always describe them as promising footballers. And if you Google promising footballer stab, you'll get any number of murders, as if all of them were part of the Arsenal development team. And it seemed to me that we weren't really seeing them as individuals and as people, and that I saw them in that way and I wanted to write their story.
It's not just the story of the investigation. It's the story of how the death ripples out over the estate where the boy comes from, and also how it affects the police team. They're not just looking for a killer. They are deeply affected by what happens.
Well, I think the most important thing to say is that it's a story, so we follow Ryan, who sees his friend stabbed. We follow him dealing with the aftermath, but also he's become involved in a gang, and we learn that that gang is trying to move up in the world and acquire firearms. So it's kind of a thriller because the police are investigating not only the murder of his friend Spencer, but also this gang. And so there are conflicts of interest between what the police prioritise. And of course, Ryan has his own agenda as to what's important. So it's kind of quite a complex novel with quite a fast-moving plot.
And the two protagonists in the police investigation are both women. They're characters who we've come to know and love in your two previous books. This feels like a very male book, which adds a level to the story which might otherwise just be a very male story about gangs and boys on the street. It shows that women are actually involved at every level.
Yes, I think this book is dedicated to my own two sons, and I think there is a sense of masculinity in it, and we see a lot more of Detective Inspector Kieran Shaw in this novel than we have in the other novels, and we see his point of view for the first time. But it is balanced up by seeing Lizzie and her take on things and the fact that she's now a young mother, and by seeing Sarah Collins' view, but also by seeing not her point of view, but we see Ryan's mother, Loretta, and how worried she is for her son. And so although it is a masculine book and it is about what's happening between men and boys, you also do see very much the effect on the women and how the women are trying to deal with that world.
I know as we came into the studio, you said you feel this is your best book so far. Is it also your most personal book so far?
Yes, in a way. I feel that my starting point was very much taken from life, from the things that I recorded that these victims said before they died. And to some extent, it feels like it was sort of ripped out of me, this book. I feel very passionate about it and actually quite exhausted by it. I'm going to write a standalone next because I don't feel like I can rush back into this world.
And the standalone, will that be another crime novel?
Yes, I mean, that's sort of under negotiation and being thought about at the moment. But yes, it'll be very different, but it'll be with a crime theme, yes.
And I understand that since we last spoke, you've also had some sight loss as well.
Well, this just cropped up because I was wearing sunglasses. I don't want to be overdramatic. I've got a diagnosis of macular degeneration, but I have to say that I'm pretty asymptomatic at the moment, but I'm having to be careful and I'm suffering the thing that I now know that people who are partially sighted suffer, which is that I wear sunglasses and people say stupid things to me about trying to go incognito and so on and thinking I'm cool, but actually I'm just trying to protect my retina.
Best-selling crime author wears dark glasses for health reasons rather than...
Yes, exactly.
Are you going to get straight back into writing the new standalone novel, or will you actually be taking some time off to read some other people's work as well?
Well, I'm always reading, as you know. I never stop reading. I'm rereading some stuff. I've just been sent a proofread copy of Rosamund Lupton's latest novel, which I shall read straight away. But no, I have had some time off since finishing Gallistry Lane, and I will be going straight into writing now. In fact, after this interview in the afternoon, I'll be at my desk.
No peace for the crime writer.
That's right.
Well, Kate London, thank you so much for coming back into the studio, telling us about Gallows Tree Lane. It's out now, I believe.
That's right. It was published on Monday, and it's in the shops and on Amazon.
And you also have some exciting news as to who the narrator's going to be, don't you?
Yes. I was very pleased that Sophie Okonedo has agreed to do the Audible book, so that is fantastic news. She's got a wonderful voice and she's really well placed to read this story.
Because you obviously wanted to get an authentic voice.
Yes, and I've long admired Sophie Okonedo, so she's just perfectly matched for it, but also she's a wonderful, wonderful actress. It's a great thing, and I think having a female voice is great, and also Sophie's from London. The whole thing fits together perfectly.
I can't wait to get my copy, and in the meantime, I wish you the best of luck with getting a pair of dark glasses that suit your macular degeneration.
Thank you.
And I hope it doesn't slow down your pace of work.
Thanks very much. Thanks for having me.
Gallows Tree Lane is out now in print and ebook, with that audiobook version on its way soon. Now it's back to CJ Tudor for the books of her life. CJ, was there a book that you read as a child or an adolescent that made you fall in love with reading and writing?
Singling it down to just one is probably quite difficult. The first book I remember sort of reading on my own was The Owl That Was Afraid of the Dark. And I remember reading that over and over and over again. And I think that's just literally when I sort of learnt to read for myself. And I loved that book. I really loved that book. It was one of my favourites. And I reach my little girl now. As I got a little bit older, Enid Blyton, I just loved. And I particularly loved the more fantastical stuff like The Magic Faraway Tree and The Wishing Chair. Remember The Wishing Chair, where they sit in the chair and end up going to these sort of fantastical lands that were... It reminds me a little bit of Doctor Who. As in, they'd go to these fantastical lands, but there was always something like a little bit sort of weird or wrong or something. They'd have to get away from it and run back down and get back down the tree again, or the wishing chair, or get back onto the wishing chair. They were kind of similar setups, basically, the tree and the chair. But I really liked that idea that you could sit in this chair and it would, or climb this tree and it would take these fantastical places. That really fired my imagination as a kid. And I think as I got a bit older, the book that obviously my hero when I was 12, and I think I probably must have had my dad's library card. They'd let you go in with the adult library cards at that stage, go into the adult section of the library, which was very exciting. And I picked up a copy of Christine from the library, I think I must have mentioned before. And that was my first Stephen King book that I read. I'd seen Stephen King books. They were always, along with Stephen King and James Herbert, because horror was really big in the 80s, they were always so tempting. You'd see them in W.H. Smith's and places, and they had this kind of garish kind of horror covers. And as an adolescent, you know, I was sort of 12, they were, you know, that sort of tempting forbidden fruit. I remember going in and finding this copy in the library and being very excited, but a bit scared as well. But I was just hooked. And, you know, I was a kid who used to get scared of quite a lot of stuff, but I found this sort of attraction towards creepy stuff. And it was just the writing and the storytelling. And I think that really did inspire me from then on. That was sort of the stuff I wanted to write and the stuff I enjoyed. And then, yes, I sort of sought out all the other Stephen King books and James Herbert. And horror very much then was my reading material for my teenage years, as it is for a lot of teenagers, actually, I think. But, yeah, I just always remember that moment. And that really was, that. This is what I want to write. This is it. This is what I want to do. So, yeah, so those are probably the books that really formed me in a way. Owl That Was Afraid of the Dark, Enid Blyton and Stephen King. So an eclectic sort of move up the reading ladder there, really.
The adventures really began on the day that Molly and Peter went out to spend 35 pence on a present for their mother's birthday. They emptied the money out of their money box and counted it. 35, said Peter. Good. Now, what shall we buy Mother? Mother loves old things, said Molly. If we could find an old shop somewhere full of old things, you know,
Funny spoons, quaint vases, old glasses and beads. Something of that sort would be lovely for Mother. She would love an old tea caddy to keep the tea in, I'm sure, or perhaps an old, old vase. All right, said Peter. We'll go and find one of those shops this very day. Put on your hat and come on, Molly.
The Adventures of the Wishing Chair by Enid Blyton can be found in a full range of accessible formats in the RNIB library, including as TB18047, which is narrated by Charlotte Norfolk.
And is there a book that on a rainy day, or a stormy day, I don't know, in your case, you'd like to curl up with and reread?
Yes, well, on a rainy or stormy, or particularly a snowy day, I think what you want to curl up with is a book that's really, really scary, obviously. So my perfect reading material, probably for a stormy day, would be... going to have to be Stephen King again, I'm afraid. I'm going to sound really dull on this one. But the book I've probably reread the most is The Shining. I can read that again and again. It's just one of those books that I will always come back to and I love. And it's perfect curling up on a stormy day reading material because, you know, the setting, the hotel, the snow, that whole feeling of isolation. I mean, you know, you couldn't ask for a better book to read if you were snowed in, depending on your mindset, I suppose, really. If you've got a partner in the corner there hammering away on their laptop, refusing to let you look at it, perhaps not so much. But yeah, I've read that book so many times and it's just one of those books I can always enjoy. I just love the sort of the imagery, the bar, Lloyd, it's just such a brilliant book. And although it is primarily a ghost story, you know, you can read it in two ways in some regards. Yes, it's a ghost story, but it's also, you know, the story of a guy who's, you know, cracking up and losing his mind in this isolated hotel. So it works sort of on all fronts, really, on what's real and what's not real. And it's just, yeah, it just builds beautifully. It does what I think a lot of books, you know, they tell you not to do these days. It builds really slowly in some ways, The Shining. A lot of people think it's really slow. But I like the fact that you don't go wham, you know, everything these days. You've got to start with a big bam and into the book. But I quite like it. I think a slow burn is really good sometimes. But yeah, it's one of my all-time favourite books. I've read it loads.
Most of the Overlook's history, savoury and unsavoury alike, I found in a scrapbook that was in the cellar. Big thing with white leather covers, gold thread for binding. Do you have any idea whose scrapbook that might be? None at all. Is it possible it could have belonged to Grady, the caretaker who killed himself? Mr. Torrance, Allman said in tones of deepest frost, I am by no means sure that Mr. Grady could read, let alone dig out the rotten apples you have been wasting my time with. I'm thinking of writing a book about the Overlook Hotel. I thought if I actually got through it, the owner of the scrapbook would like to have an acknowledgement at the front. I think writing a book about the Overlook would be very unwise, Allman said. Especially a book done from your, point of view.
The Shining by Stephen King is available in Braille, giant print and as TB14071. It's narrated by William Roberts.
And finally, is there a book you've read recently that you'd like to share with the RNIB Connect Radio listeners?
Yes, one of my favourite books that I have read in the last year that's just standout, and I'm so pleased it's got recognised with the Costa Book Awards debut award, is The Seven Deaths of Evelyn Hardcastle by Stu Turton. It's just such a unique book. It's just so utterly original. As I think I described it when I was talking about it recently to someone, it's like the best way to describe it is kind of a mashup of Agatha Christie meets Quantum Leap meets Groundhog Day. It's, you know, it's got the mysterious country house setup, the typical kind of Agatha Christie setup. But then you've got in the body swapping where the main character wakes up in a different body each day of one of the guests at this party. And it's almost impossible to explain. And every night, Evelyn Hardcastle gets killed and people are trying to solve the murder in one day that keeps repeating, but he keeps waking up as a different guest. It sounds confusing, but it's actually a joy to read because it's wonderfully complex. Incredibly clever. As I say, you know, I read it in complete awe because I was like, how on earth did he write this and tie up all the timings of the different characters? It's really, really clever. It's a lot of fun to read. It's a very clever book, but it's really enjoyable. It keeps you guessing the whole way as to what actually is going on. Not only have you got, you know, you're trying to guess who is actually responsible for the murder, it's also, what is this character doing here? What is this setup? Why has he got to keep repeating this day? Why has he got to solve this murder? It's such a clever book. And, you know, added to the fact, well, I've met Stu and he's one of the nicest people on earth. He's brilliant. He's such a lovely bloke. But, yeah, it's a book that I, you know, recommend to pretty much everybody. Just because it does something different. I read a lot of crime thrillers. It's very much my genre. But I really like books that do something different with it. And that's just one that stands out as taking it and taking the genre and really sort of turning it inside out and doing something original with it.
The presence recedes, his steps retreating into the woods as I sag, pressing my forehead to the dirt, inhaling the smell of wet leaves and rot, tears running down my cheeks. My relief is pitiable, my cowardice lamentable. I couldn't even look my tormentor in the eye. What kind of man am I? It's some minutes before my fear thaws sufficiently for me to move, and even then I'm forced to lean against a nearby tree to rest. The murderer's gift jiggles in my pocket, and, dreading what I might find, I plunge my hand inside, withdrawing a silver compass. "Oh," I say, surprised. The glass is cracked and the metal scuffed, the initials S.B. engraved on the underside. I don't understand what they mean, but the killer's instructions were clear. I'm to use the compass to head east. I glance at the forest guiltily. Anna's body must be near, but I'm terrified of the killer's reaction should I arrive upon it. Perhaps that's why I'm alive, because I didn't come any closer. Do I really want to test the limits of his mercy? Assuming that's what this is.
The Seven Deaths of Evelyn Hardcastle by Stuart Turton is available in a full range of accessible formats, including as TB703605, narrated by Jot Davis.
CJ Tudor, thank you so much for sharing your obvious passion for reading with the Read On listeners and for being a guest on the programme.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very, very much.
Don't forget that you can share the books of your life by emailing us at the usual address, readonair@rnib.org.uk. Alas, that's all we've got time for this week. My thanks to all my guests and to everyone who's been in touch. Read On will be back at the same time next week. But if you can't wait that long, why not subscribe to our podcast? We're available from all the major platforms, including iTunes, Spotify, Google Podcasts, or just search for RNIB Talking Books in your favourite podcast app. If you need any help, have any questions about the show, or just want to keep up to date with us, why not look for us on Twitter? I'm at RedSale, that's REDSZELL, and producer Robert is at talking_books. So, farewell until next week, and don't forget to read on.